And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hi everyone, I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Together we've spent half a lifetime travelling to just about every corner of the world, making a living as travel writers out of what we like doing best.
And that's skiing, biking, hiking, eating, exploring, city breaks, and a whole lot more.
Action Pack gives us each week the opportunity to share with you on the show some of these great experiences and the amazing people we meet along the way.
You can find out more about us on our website, actionpacktravel.com. Also, in the show notes, you'll find lots of detailed information about each episode.
So let's go straight to the action. This week, we're entering quite literally into the spirit of adventure, as seen through the eyes of explorer George Bullard, roving ambassador for his family's gin company. Bullard has been brewing beer and distilling gin in Norfolk since early Victorian times. George is best described as a real-life action man. Ever since he was a schoolboy, he's swum, sailed, kayaked, and walked across giant swathes of the planet in aid of scientific research or just plain adventure. Quite simply, George seeks to go higher, further, faster, longer than anyone else.
Hi, George. Welcome to the show. Lockdown must be particularly frustrating for someone like you. But people who are back in their London office, heeding government advice to avoid public transport, might like to follow your example and commute to work by kayak on the Thames.
Good morning, guys. And thank you very much for having me on your podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. So you're right. I do kayak along the Thames. It all started actually a few years ago when I used to work in finance. I used to work in the city. And I had to train for one of my expeditions, one of my adventures. And so I bought a blow-up kayak, named it Kevin, paid eBay £70 for the pleasure of it. Every morning at about 5:45 in the morning, I would pump up Kevin, much to my flatmate's annoyance. And I used to live in Battersea, and then I would paddle along the Thames into the city, and I'd get out just beneath the Banker Pub by Cannon Street Tube Station and walk through the city with Kevin on my head. You can imagine some of the slightly strange looks I got, but it all made it worthwhile when just one person looked off one of the bridges as they walked on their commute into work, and it made them smile. That kind of made it all worthwhile. I guess one of the main reasons why I decided to kayak to work, aside from training for an expedition, really was the fresh air that I got from the Thames, and it allowed me to avoid the rather less than fresh armpits and burping and farting that goes on in a tube carriage with 150 other people. So I thought, why not? Let's do it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, if other people wanted to do the same thing as you on the Thames, do you need a license? Do you need a license, or do you just put your boat in and go?
You do need a license to do it, or you at least need to do it. I spoke to the Port of London Authority just before doing it and said, look, you know, this is what I'm doing. I would like to do this. What do you think? And they sort of were scratching their heads a little bit, being like, this has never, ever, ever happened to us. And the person on the end of the phone had to go away and talk to someone else, who then spoke to someone else before they sort of got back to me. And they asked me a whole lot of questions about my experience and things. So I sent in some qualifications, which I have. And and eventually they were like, well, you must wear a life jacket and, you know, keep out of the way of traffic. And I mean, both of which are reasonably obvious. And eventually I got it. But that, I mean, there are a few stories of being chased by various police who maybe didn't get the message that I was allowed to do this. But and it's actually one morning paddling into work. I was up nearer the city end.
Are you wearing a suit? Are you wearing a suit at this stage?
Not quite, but beneath my, I had a dry suit on. So I could wear, like, you know, bits and bobs that I need to do, like my pants and things. But, you know, it's pretty rank. So and there was luckily a changing room at the office, so I could, you know, put a waterproof bag with a neatly clean shirt in, because, you know, there's some pretty unattractive things in the Thames, and diapers and all that sort of nappies and things that you come across. And Anyway, so I was paddling into the office one morning, and I never forget. It was so funny. When you get nearer the city or nearer that end of the river, there's quite a few bridges and quite a few pillars, and I could see the police waiting for me. They were 100%. I mean, their blue lights were all but on their boats. They have a boat that buzzes up and down the Thames, and I was about to collide with the police. I never forget. The only reason they didn't stop me is they just couldn't quite get close enough. I sort of darted through the pillars and the various bridge obstacles that meant that I could just about skip to my landing point and get away with it that morning. And the next morning they went. So whether they got the message or not, but it was certainly quite exciting for a couple of minutes as I was running from the police, which I hastened to add was the first and last time that I ever run away from the police.
So what started your interest in what I might describe as perpetually breaking records? This started when you were a little boy, or tell me about it.
Yeah, I get asked this a lot, Peter. A lot of people have a life experience, an illness, or, you know, a sudden experience which makes them realize just how maybe frail we all are on this planet. And that's their reason. And I've had a few of these things. I've had a few bad things happen to me, which we may come onto it soon. But most of that should be on expeditions and adventures. So where I think my adventurous spirit has come from really is actually my childhood. I think that we are all, as children, curious. We all have a sense of wonderment, a sense of what's around the corner, what's up the tree, or, you know, under the wall. We're all inquisitive and curious as to what lays around the corner. And I've just really think I've clung on to that childhood obsession with what might lay in the river or up the tree. And that kind of leads me just to continuously climb trees and stay adventurous. And obviously that's obviously procured into something rather on a rather large scale basis. But it's something which I love. I'm incredibly passionate about. I've seen the benefits that it's had for children and adults alike. That sort of the idea of the National Health Service being called the Natural Health Service, i.e., you know, there's a lot of things that we're experiencing as humans right now, a lot of conditions which we experience, which can be cured not by going to the National Health Service, but by simply going outside. That idea of the Natural Health Service, I think, is something which I really buy into, and the power of the outdoors being used to change lives, I totally buy into.
So what was the first big adventure for you? I think you swam across the channel.
I guess even as a young boy, I've been doing little adventures, but that really was, as you say, the first big one that I did back in 2004. I was a little bit older than, I was just over 14, nearly 15 years old. And that was really the first opportunity I had alongside an amazing team of swimmers and also a very, very, very inspiring coach who gave us this opportunity to swim the channel. And obviously there were a few of us in the team who were, you know, weren't so keen to do it. But equally, there was a significant proportion of the team who were like, you know what, let's go for it. What's the worst that can happen? We could fail. That's really the worst that can happen. You know, we've got a boat next door to us. We're not going to drown. So I'm going to die doing this. So let's give it a shot. See what we're made of. What have we got to lose? What is it that we might come home regretting? For me, that regret would have been not trying.
And then when was the first big one?
So the first first real huge one that I did was in 2008. I was nearly just 19, and I'd just given a talk in the RGS in London about, and the talk itself was about going down to Antarctica. We went down to go and try and find a new species of fern, to try and find Shackleton's stove on the island of South George. And I came back from that, I was giving a talk in the RGS, and this guy called Alex, who I'd never met before, came up to me and said, do you want to do this adventure with me? And this adventure was the longest fully unsupported polar journey in history at the time. And I scratched my head for about 10 seconds and thought, yeah, all right, let's give it a shot. Why not? What have I got to lose? I might fail. I might die, but we're all going to die. That's what I kind of, that's the conclusion I'd drawn in those 4 years, that we're all going to die at some point. So you might as well try. And Alex and I met, that was the first time we met. The second time we met, we were packing our sledges. And the third time we met was in Stansted Airport. We flew to Iceland first and then from Iceland to Greenland. And yeah, that was the third time we'd met. So we then set off on a journey, which it's hard to put into words, actually, even over the course of a podcast, but a journey which changed my life forever, without a shadow of a doubt, king or lying. We didn't obviously have seats. I never saw the color green. There was obviously no greenery, no green trees, things like that. And the only real proof that the world outside still existed were the planes flying over our heads as we walked for 113 days, just under 1,500 miles. It was without doubt something which I will obviously remember and cherish for the rest of my life. It's changed my perspectives on life. It's changed the way that I look at a plate of food. It's changed the way that I how appreciative I am of simple things like having a shower or putting on a clean set of clothes. I changed my underwear 0 times. I changed my base layers once. I had the same pair of pants all the time because I thought they were lucky. And luckily, I'm still alive. So I think those pants are incredibly lucky. So if you want to borrow them, you can. We ran out of food. And there's so many stories here that we could dive into. And so I'd sort of give you this one a little bit, just to give you a bit of a feeling for the days and months that passed whilst I was there. All of my friends were taking, time out in between school and university. I failed to get into university to read medicine. So I was forced to take a year out. And, all my mates were off in amazing places doing traveling and working for charities and things. And there was me on an ice cap with one other bloke for 4.5 months. At the time, maybe a slightly peculiar choice to make for a, for testosterone fueled young man, but I did. And day 104, we laid food depots on our outbound journey that we were then feeding off on the way home. So we were hot between those food depots. And on day 104, Alex was on the GPS because we'd obviously marked those depots with a GPS coordinate and also built a small cairn so that when we came back to it, the GPS would bring us back to the rough area, but the cairn would then be like, right, it's underneath that. And we didn't know whether the ice cap, no one knew actually, whether the ice cap over such a long period of time, over the summer months, would decrease or increase in height or how it changes. No one knew. So we decided we would bury our food depot about a foot under the surface of the ice and then build a big cairn as big as we possibly could manage. And we're hoping that might lead us to the depot on the way back. Alex was on the GPS and we were honing in on our second to last depot. And he said, stop, we're there. And we both looked around us. And just to give you an idea of the gravity of the situation, we might not necessarily realize it in our day-to-day lives, but we need food to survive, right? That might sound obvious, but maybe coronavirus has taught us a little bit about like what is really required to survive: food, water, and warmth. And suddenly, when we looked around us and couldn't see any evidence of any food or any mark of any human ever having been there, no cairn, nothing, flat ice. One of those key ingredients for life was torn away from us. There really isn't a word isn't a way to put that into words, because I don't think there really is a word that exists to describe it. But I guess our response, either you could break down and cry, or you could take a deep breath and realize the challenge that you have ahead of you, realize the magnitude of what you needed to do, and press on. And you know, that's pretty much what we did. After about 5 minutes of probing with a tent pole to try and find something beneath the ice, it was a futile effort because, let's be honest, we could spend half a day trying to find it. We may or may not find it at the end of the day. And then, you know, we're half a day's food behind if we haven't found it. So it was, we decided at the time to scratch it, leave the food, and go on. And that's especially annoying for me because that was the only depot where I'd had two massive treats on this expedition, and they were a pack of Taribo, or two packs of Haribo Tangfastics. And your taste buds to fresh fruit and sour explode in that environment, especially when you haven't had any of it. And so that depot was one I was looking forward to beyond all belief. So not finding it was a massive blow. So, but what I could do, I suppose, for you guys is give you the GPS coordinates. So if you're desperate for a pack of Haribo Tangfastics, you can again have a look for it if you like, because it might still be there. But and we walked. We lived off butter, which we obviously had some pure fat left over. We had we survived off 2.5 flapjacks a day, which we made into those sort of fat balls, which you feed the birds in winter. We ate it like an apple, sitting on the front of our sledges during our breaks. Alex would have a bite of the apple, then I'd have a bite of the apple. And at lunch, I'd have two bites and Alex would have two bites. And that saw us through for the last 9 days of the project. So you can see now how these sorts of things start to change your perspectives.
After that expedition, you went back to Greenland again, and then you kayaked all the way to Scotland.
In 1728, an Inuit man landed on the northeast coast of Scotland, and no one knows where he came from. I think he was bloody lost, to be honest. But 3 days later, he died. And they believe that he came from Finnmark in northern Norway, right? Northeast Scotland, northern Norway. It's a plausible journey to be someone to be lost on at sea in a kayak. And it's plausible, but pretty extreme. Anyway, we went to look at his boat, which you can go and currently see in Aberdeen Maritime Museum, and see his boat hanging up there. And you can touch, or not touch, but you can see also the paddles that he was carrying, and also the weapons that he was carrying because he was hunting. And we were also inspired by a book called Searching for Finnmen. And that describes this ancient phenomenon of this Finn man arriving on the northeast coast of Scotland. But his paddle and his hunting equipment and his kayak are all traditional Greenlandic styles. So we were like, hang on a minute, this guy did not come from Finnmark in northern Norway. He must have come from Greenland. But is that indeed possible? So the reason for the project was to unearth this ancient myth, I guess, add fuel to the fire of speculation that he may well have paddled the entire way across the North Atlantic Ocean, which is a pretty extraordinary journey to make in 1728 in such a fragile craft. The craft was made of whale bones and seal skin. Isn't that phenomenal that, you know, those sort of things existed? And now we exist in carbon Kevlar and plastic and composites. You know, it's a phenomenal feat of endurance. So that's exactly what we said. We said we'd do. We wanted to paddle a kayak all the way from Greenland back to Scotland. It was like a delicious island hop, like a Caribbean-style island hop from Greenland to Iceland, Iceland to the Faroes, and Faroes to North Rhone, and North Rhone to Scotland. But sadly, without the sun and the white sand beaches.
So how long did it take you to paddle all that way?
So the journey from Greenland to Scotland in its entirety was 66 days. But of course, there was lots of delays for weather, waiting for the right weather forecast. You know, we were in a tiny 26-foot long kayak. There was no protection from the element really at all. We didn't have a sort of dry compartment on board the boat. It was, in fact, more like a submarine than anything else. We slept down inside the boat, so we sort of shuffled ourselves down inside our cockpit and adopted what I mean the coffin position, what you'd consider. We couldn't roll over, sleep on our sides. You can't really stand up, walk around. So it was a very traditional kayak that you'd sort of see, I guess, on the TV, maybe on the slalom races. It looked quite like that. There was two of us in it, one behind the other. It was a double kayak. And as a result of us being so vulnerable, we really had to make sure that when we touched land for the last time and headed for the ocean to cross another sort of vast patch of water between these islands, between, you know, Greenland to Iceland, Iceland to the Faroes to Scotland, we really had to make sure that we were making the right decision, because we really were putting ourselves in some pretty serious danger. And there wasn't a support boat with us at all, even though the expedition was filmed by Red Bull. So you can go and watch it right now and see our misery unfold in front of you on the internet. It was sleeping was a pretty interesting challenge, as was going to the loo. We actually. Going to the loo seems to always be something that everyone's interested in, especially when you're on a kayak. We actually went to the loo on a plate. So of course you can't put your bum or arse aside, because you would fall out or the boat would rotate and you'd capsize. So we had to sort of slightly just sit up in our cockpits a little bit, slide a plate underneath our bum and do our business on this 6-inch diameter plate with very small rims. And therein lies quite a few hazards, because your loo seat is also where you work, where you paddle. It's also your pillow, where you sleep the night. So you kind of had to make a mental note of how many kids you dropped off at school and made sure that they did get dropped off at school before sitting down again. Else you'd have a rather nasty surprise.
I once kayaked around New York, around Manhattan, actually.
Oh, nice. Nice. Very good.
And you swam it?
Yes, we swam it the year after we swam the Channel. We went to go and swim around New York. So we started in South Cove, went round the East River with the current, into the Harlem River against the current, and then down the Hudson. Where did you go? That's so cool.
Just around Manhattan. It was about 10 years ago, so I can't remember exactly. It was a sunset tour. We went in a group of about 8 kayaks. Uh-huh. So we had to really stick together, because there was quite a lot of other traffic in the water, which that was.
Yes, and some big currents.
Yeah. And so we were told that we had to sort of stick together, rather like fish stick together. So you look like one great big vehicle rather than lots of little ones.
Absolutely. It makes total sense.
It's fun though, yeah.
George, your eternal quest for adventure has taken you all over the world. You once drove a tuk-tuk across India?
Yeah, that was great fun. We were sort of a group of 15 friends from university and read about this tuk-tuk challenge online and decided that, two of us decided really that we would motivate the troops enough to get them into a tuk-tuk. Just a tuk-tuk, you know, isn't... We had a motorized tuk-tuk, so it might not necessarily be the bicycle tuk-tuk you were thinking, or maybe a rickshaw. I'm never quite sure of the difference. But we started in Pokhara in Nepal and rented 5 rickshaws and drove all the way down to the southern tip of India in Cochin. And it was a truly fantastic adventure. I genuinely think that we probably drove through some places which, you know, very rarely see tourists and probably don't very often see a white person. And so it was a real opportunity to see kind of, you know, true India. We stopped in at a few of the major sites, places like Varanasi and those sorts of places, which are steeped in history, and stopped in obviously on the banks of the Ganges and saw bodies, you know, burning bodies floating down the river, as is customary with their beliefs and their religious beliefs. It was an extraordinary journey. And of course, being students, we had to, we were cutting costs every corner, every time we stopped for the night. And one evening, we'd never really book anywhere. We just sort of find somewhere that evening. One evening we came across a hotel where the only bedroom we had was the marital suite. And so 16 of us decided we would take this marital suite for, I think it added up to be sort of one pence per person for the night. And we ended up all sleeping on a heart-shaped bed. which was very romantic. We, by and large, we try to avoid the larger roads, which I kind of added to the adventure a little bit, added to the to the seclusion. But you're right, I was led to believe that the bigger roads in India are pretty dangerous, actually, and pretty nasty. That was where we had our only accident of the trip. One of the guys had a collision with a lorry, which sounds more concerning than it actually was. Everyone was fine. But there was still a rickshaw, a tiny vehicle, and a lorry, a massive vehicle involved in a collision. But everyone was okay. Oh, and someone was held at gunpoint, actually. That's a good point. I forgot about that. One of the team stopped for some reason in a village and were offered a cup of tea by the locals. And they said, yeah, we'd love to. That's so kind. Thank you. And obviously, maybe assumed incorrectly that the tea was a gesture of goodwill. I think it turned out to be something different. And when we saw them that evening, they were totally pale, completely white, and totally sort of shell-shocked as they had to run away in their rickshaws from men with guns, asking them for some rupees to pay for their tea.
Have you had any other dangerous experiences, near-death experiences on your travels?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have. And it fortunately didn't happen to me directly, but I certainly had an experience which certainly has changed me again. In 2011, I was an adventure guide. I was a guide on an expedition where we took around 75 young people to Svalbard. And it was about 2 weeks into the trip, and everything was phenomenal. The anticipation, the excitement had not worn off, but was still bubbling away. Everyone's having a fantastic adventure. We were about 2 hours or maybe an hour helicopter ride, half a day's boat ride really, away from the main town of Longyearbyen at the base of the Von Posbreen Glacier, which some people might know. We were camping there on the beaches and we were doing, the purpose of the trip was all around youth development, scientific research and leadership skills for these kids who were all between the ages of 16 and 23. 2 weeks into the project, my particular team was just about to get really stuck into a crossing at Svalbard. And I happened to have the doctor in my group as well, or one of the doctors. And we found out at 7:30 on the Friday, the 6th of August, that a polar bear had attacked and killed one of our teammates. Fortunately, that wasn't in my group, but our team and my leader team, I guess, were one of the first guys to arrive there that morning because we had the doctor and stuff. So it was a pretty significant situation that we were then faced with, which certainly affected me pretty deeply. And initially, you believe that it's your fault, that you should have done more to protect this guy from being attacked by a polar bear. Anyway, the long and short of it, really, from a legal standpoint, is that it's gone through lots of different inquests and public inquests and private inquests and things, and it's generally been put down to an accident. So I guess after a little bit of therapy and chatting with people, I'm now sort of more comfortable with the idea that I was guiding an expedition where a young man got killed by a polar bear.
Yes, these kind of dreadful experiences can change your life a bit, can't they?
So you do a lot of work with young people, sort of passing on your enthusiasm to them.
Yeah, it's now really my mission is to rewild humans. It's not just young people or anyone in particular, really. Just humans in general, I think, have become incredibly disconnected with our planet to such an extent that, now a treatment for mental illnesses or mental wellness problems is to go and sit outside and dig your fingers into the earth or the sand or the pebbles on a beach and just ground yourself. For me, that's a siren that says we are totally disconnected with the magic of the outside. It's now really inspired me to carry on taking kids on expeditions, organizing bushcraft events for kids, started a company called City Camping, and we put up pop-up secure campsites in parks and green spaces around around our cities here in the UK. And we asked people to come and spend a single night under Canvas. We provide all of the infrastructure and all of the sort of raw materials they're going to need. We just ask they turn up with a pair of pajamas and a warm sleeping bag to spend the night under Canvas. And I passionately believe in the power of the outdoors. I truly think it can change lives. It's changed mine profoundly, and it's had effects far deeper than I could ever conceive. And I'm very keen on not only passing them on through organizing events, but also speaking and hopefully, you know, be able to inspire, to engage people, both adults and kids alike, through the power, through sort of social media and various companies which I'm now involved in. Argo Adventures was brought about really because of my passion and my team and my business partner's passion for getting people outdoors, not just kids, but adults alike. Argo's mission is to curate real adventures with purpose. What we've done is pull together unique itineraries that allow people to go on not just an adventure, not just a holiday. They allow people to go away and it gives them the chance to give back at the same time. So, for example, you might go to the Azores, slightly off the beaten track, an amazing set of islands off the African coast, and you won't just go there for an adventure in a kayak. You'll go there on an adventure in a kayak with a local guide to go and survey the local dolphin population, for example. Or we also run the trips into Carpathia in Romania. You don't just go on an adventure to Carpathia in Romania on a bicycle. What you will do is go there and survey and gather information and data around the reintroduced wolves and brown bears, which roam free in the Carpathian Mountains. So really, it's an adventure with purpose.
That's great. Tell us a little bit more about your personal philosophy. As we speak, the society in which we live is changing in a way that was unimaginable just a few short months ago. You've so far spent your life testing yourself to the ultimate limit in all sorts of circumstances all over the globe. Has it given you an unusual perspective on existence? And will the world emerge as a better place in the longer term after the passing of this pandemic?
There's actually no doubt that what I've done has, and the experiences which I've been fortunate enough to do and to experience, have changed me deeply and all of my perspectives on life. And just to illustrate it somewhat, it's so difficult to, the coming back from an expedition is very difficult mentally, because, or any experience actually that you've had, coming back from that is very difficult mentally because you've just had this incredible experience. It might even be a holiday people have been on, the most amazing time you've had. You've had emotions and feelings, seen things which maybe humans have never seen before. I've certainly experienced that, those feelings, like genuinely witnessing things which I believe treading places where no human has trodden before. And you come back and all of your friends are dying to hear about it. But actually, you simply cannot put into words what it's actually like to be there. And the only way to find out what it's like, what the experience that I had, was to be there with me. And that almost alienates you a little bit from those people who are desperate to find out what it was like. So they've changed me, definitely. Expeditions have. What the beauty of this pandemic has done is that actually we've all experienced something together. We've all had to appreciate things together that we can all now understand. We can all take forward as a population of people who are fortunate enough to call planet Earth their home for a few years. We've had this extraordinary experience where we've had to put down the mobile phone for an hour and walk outside, appreciate what's going on outside. And I think therein lies really the core difference, something that we've been through all together. Our appreciation for our freedom, for our wilderness and our nature is now something which I believe post COVID-19 we will appreciate even more. And I hope that as a population, post COVID-19, we will endeavour to, as a government as well, to embark on putting the planet's climate back on track. That might lead me nicely into my next project. So my expedition this winter is called the Dark Ice Project. We are heading up onto the Arctic Ocean in the depths of winter to gather never-before-seen content, imagery, and data. So we'll be getting a boat locked into the ice at the end of summer, letting the ice form around us from that boat, being able to conduct a series, gather a series of scientific data, which we can then send back live from the middle of the Arctic Ocean in the depths of winter. Yeah, as I'm sure most of you know, the Arctic Ocean is a pivotal barometer to the health of our entire planet. It acts like a freezer. It acts like the Earth's cooler. So as soon as we lose the thin layer of ice that forms a crust over the Arctic Ocean, as soon as we lose that, we then enter a negative feedback loop of ocean warming. As the sun's rays consistently now warm the ocean, the Arctic Ocean beneath it, the ice will not have a chance of coming back. So the fact that we don't know very much about the Arctic Ocean in winter is extremely concerning for me. And I'm hopeful that as this expedition starts to come out a little more over the coming months, weeks and months, will also concern other people and give them a reason to follow and engage with this project. We are heading up onto the Arctic Ocean this winter to gather never-before-seen content, imagery, data, research for leading scientists and universities all over the globe with a view or with a hope that it will allow governments, or the data we collect will allow governments, corporates, and individuals to make more informed and better decisions around how to protect our planet, and in particular, the precious ice on the Arctic Ocean.
George Bullard, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we wish you the very best of luck with Dark Ice, your next expedition this winter to the Arctic Ocean.
Peter and Felix, thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been an absolute joy.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.